What are you afraid of?
Terrorism.
Vaccinations. Global warming.
The genetic engineered foods.
Earthquakes.
All the surveillance.
Cancer.
The Ebola virus.
Welcome to FearCast, the show that tells you what to be afraid of and what not to. You're listening to KPCRadio.com, and I'm your host, LJ Williamson. Today is an extra fearful episode of FearCast. It is our Halloween episode. My guest is Dr. Brian Gendron, assistant professor of psychology here at Pierce College and Pierce College's resident zombieologist. Professor Gendron, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So there is a question that has plagued scientists for generations, and that is, do zombies exist? And why, I've always wondered, why hasn't the scientific community been able to come up with any answers to that question? And why isn't more being done to prepare for the coming zombie apocalypse?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm certainly not prepared for the zombie apocalypse, so I'm hoping that it doesn't occur. I think that the reason, if we're just generalizing it first, the reason that science has not been able to debunk whether or not zombies exist or any other supernatural phenomena is because there are theories about how the brain works, and some of those might explain some of these phenomena that we'll talk about. But the truth of the matter is we're not 100% sure. The brain is extremely complex. It's capable of all sorts of funny business. Some of them might result in the perceptions of zombies and things like that. But to be honest, we don't know exactly how the brain works. And we're learning more and more every single day. But to be honest, we're not there yet. And so we cannot definitively say one way or the other at this point. But we have some compelling evidence.
Compelling evidence about the existence of zombies?
Perhaps the opposite. Perhaps compelling evidence that zombies do not exist.
What? There,
there are certainly plenty of cases where people report instances of zombies. But if you take a neurological approach, you might be able to explain all of this completely rationally.
Okay. So what you said about the complexity, the very high level of complexity of the brain, does that account for its deliciousness to zombies?
It probably does.
Okay.
I certainly enjoy food that's more complex in terms of the notes and flavors, and I'm no zombie, but I can't speak for them, but I imagine that might be an appealing aspect.
How do I know, for example, that you're not a zombie? I mean, how does the ordinary layperson typically distinguish between a zombie and a non-zombie?
You have no way of knowing if I'm a zombie or not.
Really?
I think you have to stay on guard, watch your brains, and if I begin to look at you in a way that seems odd, perhaps I show my teeth and reach for your head, then you probably want to start walking away from me.
Okay. I will keep an eye on that, and I hope my listeners do too. So as for the more scientific aspects of zombieism, you have written a scientific treatise on the topic on your very interesting website, WTF, as in whatthefreud.com, and I was wondering if you could expound upon your theories.
Absolutely. I would love to. Much of my interest in all of this, much of my interest in science in general comes from the mystery that is the human. The idea that we, in the year 2014, still have very little idea of, you know, how things work. And I brought in a book written by a prominent neuropsychologist or a neuroscientist, V.S. Ramachandran. And he is one of the leaders in the field in terms of interesting case studies. And I'll talk about a couple in a minute. But just a quote. This book, because it'll give you an idea of just how complex the brain is. He says that...
And tasty, yes.
He doesn't get into the taste, but it certainly addresses the complexity. He says, a piece of your brain the size of a grain of sand would contain 100,000 neurons, 2 million axons, and 1 billion synapses all talking to each other. So the utter complexity, the idea that thought or consciousness or perception of what is the, you know, what is the world around us. It's the product of such complexity that we, the human, is not really capable of understanding that complexity. And I certainly am not able to understand it, but I'm interested in that idea and I want to learn more about it. So I have written some things about it. There are a number of rare disorders that scientists have classified, and there's an interesting website. It's the National Organization of Rare Disorders, and you can go on that website and read all about very odd phenomena. But in terms of zombies, there are a couple of disorders in which either the individual believes that he or she is surrounded by zombies, or even in other instances that that individual has become a zombie, that they either cease to exist or that they are dead. Let me first talk about a delusion known as Capgras. Capgras syndrome or Capgras delusion was first identified in 1923 by the man named Joseph Capgras. And the basic characteristic that weaves its way through all of the afflicted individuals with Capgras is that they believe that their close loved individuals are imposters. So before going on, who would you consider, in terms of your family members, who's the closest individual to you?
My children.
Okay, your children. Imagine going home today. Everything seems normal as always. You drive in your car. Nothing is normal. You still can function in every normal, seemingly normal way. And as you get home, you enter your house and, let's say, from behind, you see one of your children and everything seems normal. You say, "Hello, son," and your son turns around and it's not your son. It's an imposter. It's an absolute imposter, somebody pretending to be your son. Everything seems normal, except this is clearly somebody pretending to be your son. So you immediately, you probably would turn around and, I don't know, how would you react to that?
Well, are you saying that visually, to my visual sense, he, in every respect, resembles my son? Yet there's just a perception that this is someone else, even though the visual and the contextual things are all there.
Absolutely. This person looks entirely like your son, but you know in your deepest of, you know, in your, right deep down in your soul, it's not your son. This is an imposter.
Is it similar to like deja vu, where you have a sense that something has happened before, even though it really hasn't? That you're with that perception?
Well, even in deja vu, you are aware that you are experiencing something. Like, there's a false reality with deja vu. This is something that you believe, you 100%, this is your truth. This is your absolute perception that this is not your son.
So it's a stronger degree than we've experienced with deja vu.
Absolutely. This is your life. This is, you know, your perception, and you're convinced it's not a hallucination. You're convinced that you're not being afflicted by drugs or any, you know, psychotropic elements. So this is one of the defining features of this symptom or this syndrome called Capgras syndrome. It was first identified in 1923, but since then we've learned more and more about it. The problem is that it's extremely rare, and so we only get bits and pieces from case studies. In 1994, there was an instance in which some Italian researchers they write about this case study in the journal Psychopathology, in which essentially an individual claiming to be afflicted by Capgras syndrome committed homicide. They came home in the same situation that we were just discussing. The individual believed that their family members were imposters and he murdered them. And so that was in 1994. And what that's led us to believe is it's possible that in certain instances of homicide, we can't rule out the idea that these individuals truly believed that their loved ones were imposters.
Is there an established link between this and something like schizophrenia, or is there any understanding of a connection of those two, or is it just too little understood to make that connection?
Well, I think I would agree with in that example, kind of the middle ground, because even something like schizophrenia is not fully understood. It's this idea that the brain works through diffuse neural processing, something like vision, for example. It's not just the case that when light, is reflected into your retina, that information travels to only one part of your brain. For vision, for example, there are so many different aspects of your brain that are involved. For example, you have areas associated with perceiving edges. You have areas that perceive colors and motion and so on and so forth. There's a similar disorder called prosopagnosia, where people have an inability to recognize faces. Yet, if you were talking to a loved one on the telephone, you would have no problem identifying that this is the person you know, but something about seeing them in person, perceiving their face, there's a disconnect.
There's another psychological phenomenon associated with zombies too, not that the people around you are somehow imposters or zombies, but that you yourself are a zombie?
That's exactly right. And that, I think you're getting at, is more commonly referred to as Cotard delusion. In Cotard delusion, very similar to Capgras delusion, the afflicted actually deny the existence of either certain parts of their body. There have been cases where people deny the existence of arms, for example, and you can tell them, like someone might say, my left arm does not exist. And you can say, well, your left arm is right there. And how they will respond is something like, I don't know what that is, but it's not my left arm. And so, again, it's a very similar disorder to Capgras. And absolutely, in certain individuals with Cotard delusion, they absolutely believe that they are dead, that they are, in essence, a zombie. And there's relatively common characteristics of Cotard. Two, in particular, self-negation. They deny the existence of other certain parts of their body or their entire body. Some individuals deny the existence of the world. And there are nihilistic beliefs, the idea that life is meaningless. Now, getting back to your original question about schizophrenia, there's absolutely a comorbidity issue here, that there's definitely going to be an overlap, some relationships between various mental issues or mental disorders. And so I wouldn't rule out the idea that there's a common thread between schizophrenia and Cotard and Capgras delusion.
And I assume that Cotard is rare in the way Capgras is as well?
Absolutely. In terms of how rare, there was a 2010 study looking at a large population of psychiatric inpatients, a population of about 1,300 suffering from very, very serious neurological and psychiatric disorders. And of that population, only 3 presented symptoms of Cotard. Now, having a neurological or psychiatric disorder in and of itself is rare. And what this data is suggesting, that it's rare within a population of rare individuals to begin with.
Okay. Well, so you're of the somewhat controversial belief that zombies do not exist then. But I saw a really fascinating documentary on the topic by a researcher named George A. Romero. His film was called Dawn of the Dead. Are you familiar with that? He presented some very compelling evidence.
Can you be more specific?
Oh, well... No, maybe we have to rent it sometime. But so your position is that zombies don't exist. So what about ghosts? Certainly they're real.
I think that ghosts may exist. But in terms of what the science says, there may be a rational explanation for ghosts. And, how would you describe a haunting? What do you think the typical haunting looks like? If you could describe an average haunting.
Oh, yeah, that's easy. A transparent figure of a human pops out of their dead body and floats around in an effort to resolve their unresolved existential crises from the time of their period when they were alive on Earth.
Okay. Very specific. Thank you. I think that...
Wasn't that the agreed upon scientific definition?
That's a new definition to me.
Oh, is it?
I
okay.
think... I mean, you're absolutely right that people, and they're actually very credible people who claim ghost sightings, so it is hard to wonder, or it is interesting to wonder whether or not ghosts are real when you have very credible, intelligent people claiming instances like you just described, and things like a sensed presence. You feel like somebody is in the room with you even though you know you're home alone, or like a wave of fear overcoming you, and even being tactile sensations, feeling like something touched you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's fascinating evidence to suggest that all of that could be a simple, simple is the wrong word to use, in fact, a very complex process of the brain. At the same time, it's possible that ghosts really do exist. So bear with me for one second. There is this researcher named Persinger who, in 2001, he heard about a story of a haunting. There's a couple who, you know, they experienced that sensed presence, feelings of a proximal being in their home, and they couldn't understand these waves of fear that would overcome them, and all they could attribute it to was ghosts. Persinger, a neuropsychologist with also apparently an interest in the paranormal, he went to the home with the electromagnetic scope. Are you familiar with that tool that measures electromagnetic activity?
Yeah, that one.
Essentially, he measured electromagnetic activity in the home, and he essentially used that as to build a hypothesis that maybe electromagnetic currents, which are found in various places around town, maybe that's causing some certain reaction in the brain. So what he did was devised an experiment, a double-blind experiment, and that's the absolute golden standard in science when neither the participant nor the researcher knows which condition they're in. And what he did was he experimentally induced feelings of hauntings by essentially applying weak, complex electromagnetic fields to a specific area of the brain. That area of the brain is the temporoparietal region. And if you were thinking about your head, it would be on the side towards the back. And the theory is that electromagnetic fields might disrupt melatonin levels. And your brain uses melatonin for a number of things, for sleep, for instance, sleep regulation. But one of the things it acts as is an anticonvulsant. It prevents your brain from seizing. And these electromagnetic fields, what they did was caused mini seizures in the brain. They're not extremely harmful, but what they do is affect perception. And so in these studies, when people were induced with these electromagnetic currents, they experienced those, you know, aforementioned characteristics of a sensed presence, waves of fear, such that they felt haunted. Now, the question that remains that Persinger still poses is that there's two possible outcomes here. The first is that hauntings are simply the product of being exposed to electromagnetic currents, and those certainly exist in various environments. At the same time, it's possible that rather than these electromagnetic currents causing seizures, which then bring about these false sensations, it's still possible that these electromagnetic currents simply make us more sensitive than we already normally are.
To the ghosts that clearly exist.
Exactly, to the ghosts that may exist.
Okay, so Persinger, basically with this electromagnetic current creating device, essentially manufactured ghosts then, right? That's what was happening, or at least manufactured the sensations associated with ghosts.
Yeah, and this could be a rational explanation for why people from all demographics have experienced hauntings, and there's no really easy solution or explanation.
Okay. So we've established, I guess, that your position is, I guess, that zombies don't exist, and neither do ghosts. So I guess murderers, they're not real either, are they?
Murderers?
Yeah.
Murderers certainly exist.
Oh, whoops.
Yes.
Oh, no.
And I think that, in terms of similar processes, we are, we could explain some instances of homicide and murder in terms of very similar processing, that idea of the diffuse neural processing we were getting at earlier. So there is some evidence to suggest that One predictor of the likelihood of being a murderer is how good your sense of smell is. And if you think about what smell does, smell is a very emotional characteristic. For instance, you might be walking around town and smell something and it triggers a memory. When you smell something, the idea of olfaction or smell, that information is processed heavily by your limbic system and your amygdala in particular. And your amygdala is something that regulates things like fear and aggressive behavior. And so you could argue that people who have a decreased sense of scent have emotional problems in terms of things like empathy. And if you have if you're lacking on empathy, it's much easier to hurt other individuals. What's weaving through all of these ideas, I think, is that the idea of diffuse neural processing, there are complex pathways in the brain, trillions of them. And when one is disconnected, the outcomes could be, various. It could end up in various outcomes.
Wait, which is coming first? You're saying that, forgive me for not being clear on this, are you saying that if someone is, for example, born with a olfactory defect of some sort, that would lead them to these kind of antisocial behaviors, or is it the other way around, that the antisocial behaviors are...
It's the first way around. I think that scent is so closely tied to emotional processing, because scent, like I said, olfaction is processed through the same brain regions in which in which emotions are processed. And so, if you have a bad sense of smell, you might at the same time have low empathy. Theoretically, it's not going to explain most murders, though.
Oh, okay. Well, that's disappointing. I thought we were going to have an answer.
I wish, yes.
To that, yeah. Well, I think that's just about all the time we have for our special Halloween show. Dr. Gendron, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
That is FearCast for October 28th, 2014. Special thanks to faculty advisor Jeff Favre and program director Matt Gottesman, who is deathly ill right now. Deathly ill. And so also thanks to Milo Anderson, who is sitting in for him. Our theme music was composed by Solo Goodspeed. Coming up next at 11:30 is The Venue with Lucy Yende. I'm LJ Williamson for KPCRadio.com. And remember, don't be afraid of the wrong things. Be terrified of the right ones. Thanks for listening. Happy Halloween.